Cool, man. So yeah, we can just kind of get into it here, but yeah, nice to meet you again. It's pretty cool. You know, my brother, you know, small world, like we were just saying, from Orlando. Now you're living in Denver. So, we, wanted to have you on, or actually Nathan introduced me to you and said it would be a good idea to have you on to talk a little bit about some of this cool stuff that's happening in kind of the front end tooling space. And since, you know, a lot of our audience are front end developers, and we've spent a lot of the last few episodes kind of getting into the nitty gritty of ES modules and all this stuff. Yeah, I thought it would be a fun idea to have you on and talk about what you're doing at Pika. So welcome to the show, and thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So yeah, I think maybe the best place to start is just to... Well, there's really a lot here, but really Pika is a little confusing as an outsider. What is it? Is it an open source project? And now it's apparently a company and you have a job there. So do you get paid in GitHub stars? So maybe you could just start by talking about what you do at Pika.
Yeah, yeah, sure. So what I do at Pika is still in the process of being defined. My title is just engineer at Pika. It started as a open source project, which you might be familiar with. It started with Pika Pack, Pika Web. I can go back into the history of that. So the history is open source. The future, we're still kind of working out. This might be a good, like, just pin in, like, the history of the company. So the foundation is open source. The foundation will always be open source. And that's a core mission of the company, to keep things available for dev and push the ecosystem forward. Fred and I were talking about a vision statement this week. The vision statement is making the internet faster, which is pretty broad, right? But there's just so much exciting things that are happening in JavaScript, which has kind of turned into like this lifeblood of the internet. Try not to get like too big picture, but it affects so much. And when you have all these exciting changes, you know, ES Next, ES modules, the new ways you can deliver applications. There's a real opportunity there to make a lot of improvements. Like we're seeing a reduction in tooling. You know, Snowpack is a really cool pin in that story of being able to build an application without like the overhead and the layers and the debugging and the configuration. Basically just mostly provided by ES modules. Kind of where we see it going we do kind of see some future in the CDN. Dino 1.0 came out not too long ago, a couple of weeks now, as of the recording of this podcast. You know, Dino is this new runtime that's made by the creator of Node, and the ability to load a package from any URL, like to actually like really utilize the network, is incredible and astounding. And
truly,
it's something that JavaScript is going to really have to take some big steps to catch up with, you know, being designed with like Node and NPM, and all packages are local. All imports are synchronous. You kind of talked about this in one of your podcast episodes, you know, the browser is a difficult runtime.
Yes. Yes.
You kind of got
the world's worst, the world's hardest, or most complex, rather.
Yeah. 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 So this is kind of a long-winded answer, but like there's value that we see in providing, you know, just doing a lot of lifting for developers. That's kind of like, you know, in between like the open source space and hosting packages in a way that's like easy for developers to use. So we're still kind of defining what that story looks like exactly.
Really interesting stuff. There's a lot there. I know you said without going too high level, but I think it might be interesting just to spend a little bit of time there. And basically, I guess my question is, what is like the high level motivation? Like, how did this come about? Because I feel like, especially with tools, you know, whether open source tools or frameworks or libraries or whatever, it always helps to understand like what problem they were designed to solve to help understand why I might use them. So you said the mission is to make the internet fast. Like, where is that coming from? Did you all you know, did you and the other kind of co-founders work somewhere where it was slow and it bothered you? Is it more of just like a personal belief about how the web should behave? Where did that kind of come from, that mission?
Yeah, that's a great question. There have been some articles come out. There was an article that came out about like the actual cost of JavaScript frameworks that came out about a month ago. I'm blanking on the title. But there have been a lot more research kind of showing, you know, the internet has a ton of JavaScript. I think you can argue whether or not that's necessary. I think there's definitely an argument of like, I'm in the camp, like there's a reason why React is so popular. There's a reason why I think it's not fair to just paint that. It's just like this negative image of like, oh, there's so much JavaScript. That's just bad by default. Like, I think there's a story there.
I'm so glad you said that, man, because that's exactly how I feel about it. And when people get on this like train of thinking and it sounds like all you hear is like, we just need to reduce JavaScript. Well, it's like you can't ignore the fact that it grew so much and there is a reason why. It grew.
Right. Yeah. And a little bit of a side tangent. I was like digging into like just the history of the internet. I'm like, you know, just it's always kind of a nice refresher just to like, go back and challenge your assumptions of like, how is this actually designed? And like, you know, Tim Berners-Lee designed this is basically like, I think of it as like Microsoft Word Online. Like the internet is meant to really first and foremost be basically just like text documents, just reference, you know, that was what it was designed to do, is to serve these documents over a network. Mm-hmm. It's really great for that. HTML is wonderful for that. But like when mm-hmm. you get into these interactive experiences, I mean, that's literally something that the internet was not designed for, these really rich interactive interfaces, you know? So we've had to do like a lot of like cheating, you know, to deliver all this functionality with JavaScript, you know, these crazy, amazing, awesome, beautiful UIs, we can't get with just HTML. And that's not to say that like people don't put more into JavaScript than they should. I think they should. I think some people are too quick to adopt a heavy framework, or some people don't consider the cost of JavaScript. All that's true. But yeah, you can't just wipe away and say, this is there for absolutely no reason. We should remove JavaScript either.
Yeah. Interesting. Basecamp just released the email product, and they are pretty hard-lined about this, and basically take a position where they kind of like minimize the amount of JavaScript they use intentionally, so they don't even minify their source, so folks can kind of view source and learn from their pages. So they take a really strong position on this, partly because it's just what they believe, and they want to kind of double down on that. You know, they're not typically ones for black and white thinking or nuanced thinking. They go for the more black and white kind of perspective on things. They like to go all the way one or the other direction.
The Rails people, really?
Yeah, exactly. DHH and Jason Fried, I love them, but they also have a lot of they can be very narrow focused, I think, sometimes. But that's just, again, that's their perspective. And I saw Alex Russell, who is a big advocate for, you know, people should, you know, be really conscientious of how much JavaScript they're shipping and worry about page weight and stuff. He was commenting on Hey and saying, you know, this is the way to go. This is how you should be building modern websites and web apps, and take a page from this book. And, you know, the more time you invest learning technologies like HTML and CSS and the less in JavaScript frameworks like React, the better. And so that's kind of the opposite perspective here. But I think, you know, blessed are the balanced is a phrase I like. And I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. So just all that to say, again, I like the perspective here that, of course, people can jump too fast into using a front end framework. But at the same time, if you're building a Trello or a Notion or a Google Calendar, you know, a lot of us have worked on complex applications like that without a framework, and you end up with kind of a Franken framework. So there's a reason these things exist, right?
Yeah, totally. And everyone is too quick to lump in like all these different stories, all these different people on earth that use the internet, all these different types of things you can build. There's not enough nuance there. And, you know, like, yeah, having an email website that is super text heavy, you can really simplify things. And that's different from a marketing website has to be big and flashy and animated. And you know, this UI that you're in day in, day out is your primary job function as a essential tool. Has to be really interactive, probably have a lot of JavaScript, not be super, there's so many different things you can build with the web.
Yeah.
And frameworks excel in one area and they fall short in others. And
cool. So the fast thing, I mean, it sounds like you all really, so how many people are on the team right now?
Right now, it's just me and Fred, actually.
Cool. And Fred gave the talk at Dino.js, right?
I believe so. I was not there for Dino.js, unfortunately, but
I think he was the one who talked about Snowpack there. And I learned a lot from that talk. It was a really great talk. So basically, long story short, you and Fred just care a lot about speed. And it sounds like you're kind of wanting to meet front-end developers where they're at instead of telling them, you know, slapping them on the wrist. Let's see how we can meet you where you're at, but make both your development experience faster and the apps that you ship faster for the end user.
Yeah, absolutely. You nailed it. Yeah, speed and meeting developers where they are essential. To kind of paint more of a picture of what that speed looks like. We know that React is a really popular framework. It excels at a lot of things. Like, I've written a ton of React. Like, I think it's really well designed. And it's also prevalent on so many websites. And you hit all these different websites that all use React. You jump from React website to React website. You have to download React a lot. And I think even minified, I think it's still 120 kilobytes or something like that for React and React DOM. And that's not nothing, because that also unpacks, Adi Osmani is good about this, the cost of JavaScript, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's good about advocating, it's not just the size. It's not just an image or an asset you're downloading. This takes, this is a script, this takes computing resources, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so for every kilobyte, that's not only bandwidth and network time, that's also processing power, and that's going to be all really, really slow. The more JavaScript you have, the slower it's going to run, exponentially, especially on older devices.
Right.
So it's it's unfair to say all that JavaScript is there for no reason, because it's there for a reason. It's serving a purpose. But what we're also saying is that we can serve really basically the same experience, but just serve it more efficiently.
Right.
You know, what if React could load from a CDN where a user only has to pay that React cost once and then it gets reused on all their websites. When you look at the actual difference, a lot of web apps, the node modules weight, I can't say an exact percentage. I want to say most, if not every web app that I've built in my career, the actual unique code to that website is much, much smaller than the actual dependency weight
mm-hmm.
and the framework weight. So what if we could offload that?
Right.
And what if we could serve that from a CDN, which is kind of old school and new school at the same time?
Totally. I mean, when I got started, that's what we were doing. jQuery from a CDN. That was the best way to do it. It's actually best practice, you know, because if users happen to all, if we all started doing that, then users would start being able to just use a cached version. I mean, a lot of people still do that with fonts, right? You know, it's the same idea.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty interesting. So, so Pika is kind of part company, part open source or open source core company. And what do y'all have, a product or a business model yet? Or do you know, what is the story here? Because one of the things I'm just personally interested in is sustainability in open source. I think there's a lot of problems with that. I myself have worked on open source projects and moved on from them and seen that pattern over and over again. You know, we had Mike Purim on from Sidekick in the Rails community, and he's managed to sustain development on Sidekick for a long time. And so I'm always interested to learn what I can from folks thinking about this problem.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think the business model is still being defined. So this is not really, I think it's to be determined. But a tenet that Fred and I have talked about is, again, keeping things open source, keeping things free, whatever we can open source and make use for developers is something we never want to compromise on, no matter what. Kind of a stretch, but Vercel used to be called Zite. you know, is a good model of like releasing Next.js, this amazing community tool. They've released some other really great open source stuff. And then for a hosting platform, like it's always been free for projects and to mess around and to also deploy some really simple stuff or some open source stuff. It's always been free, and hopefully it always will be. Right. So those kind of values are core to Pika and the mission that we want to have.
Got you. But you don't have any specific ideas yet for like what your first paid product will be, let's say.
Not really. No. We're actually still developing that. Like we think with the CDN, again, with that story of like developers hosting things for open source, building small projects, we want the CDN to be free. The Dino community has been a big fan of the Pika CDN, with that being a really big story of Dino. So we want to keep that, but we also see like for people that want to, you know, that have large enterprise companies that want to get more out of it, that want to basically just flip a switch or just add a plugin to their Webpack configuration that can load, like, you know, for example, maybe like a region specific thing, you know, for their users, like multi-region or something that's really advanced, or where they can just flip a switch and their everything just loads faster, all their JavaScript properties, something like that.
Cool. Very cool. Awesome. Yeah, the Dino thing was interesting. I think I heard about a lot of this stuff, like Pika was getting in the news a lot at the same time for different reasons. You know, it seemed like, anyways, from my perspective, like Snowpack 2 came out, Vite came out, which also helped like augment the story about bundle lists, like local development. Fred gave the talk, and then Dino came out, and you're like, wait, no node modules? Are you serious? It's like a dream come true. And then they're like, oh yeah, just go to this Pika CDN page, and you can see which modules are like web ready. And that is kind of what started me down this rabbit hole of just getting, you know, intrigued by this whole thing and seeing like, what does it mean? Like, why do we use node modules? What is a web module? Like, what does it mean for a module to be web ready? So it's like a lot of really cool ideas in here. What are you working on right now as far as like your day to day? Do you have like one project that y'all are kind of working on, or are you kind of helping to maintain all these different pieces of Pika?
So yeah, like Snowpack 2 came out, you know, we've seen some really good feedback, some suggestions on how to make it better. Like we just had a pull request for, you know, with Snowpack 2, we released a plugin system. And so we've seen people building plugins. We worked with the Preact team to generate like a web-ready version of Preact, which is all ES module powered, which is pretty cool. There's a Webpack plugin where you can use ES modules and then just do a little bit of like configuration in Webpack and still have your ES modules, but then like use some like more powerful stuff that, you know, you get from a more mature ecosystem like Webpack. And we've seen PRs with people like actually using this stuff. Like I just merged one this morning of someone that added like multi bundle support for Webpack, like powered by Snowpack. And I'm not sure exactly what they're building with it, but like it's cool to see people like take this build tool and make it their own. And also like, you know, again, with meeting developers where they are being such a crucial part of the story, like, yes, you know, we would like to see everything use ES modules. We'd like to see everything be like, you know, just this pure new world. But we really have to build a bridge there and be kind to the developers who are just, you know, at their jobs or just doing hobby stuff. Like we're all working with limited time. You know, we are still in an NPM world, moving to a post NPM world. It'll take time. It'll take some tooling for us to kind of like pave the steps forward.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's been the focus, at least right now, is like support Snowpack, listen to the community and listen where the needs are and just invest some time in there. Cause yeah, Snowpack is kind of a core part of this ES module story where like everyone's using ES modules and everyone's, you know, not having to NPM install anymore and they get to load it from CDNs and everything's super fast and awesome.
Right.
And Snowpack is a step forward to that.
I see. It's a good sign that, I just triggered Siri. That's funny. It's a good sign that, artificial intelligence, it's a good sign that people are able to use Snowpack in their existing projects, because again, a tool like this, like you just said, you know, exposing the lower level pieces, I'm sure it's not, it's always, I find it tempting as someone who works on open source wanting to provide nice high level APIs. And I was just dealing with this morning and then getting stuck down the road because you went too high level. You didn't anticipate people's use cases. And now they're stuck because they don't have the low level power that they need access to actually do their job, you know?
Yeah. And Node is over 10 years old and, you know, it was designed with common JS, you know, that require thing that we were used to using. And there's still common JS being written. There's a lot of good packages, even for front end, still written in common JS. And we can't just say, let's just throw all that away. It's just, it's too much.
Yeah.
So we actually do, we handle common JS pretty well. It's not easy, but we do. You know, you do hit into impossibilities where, like, you know, you have this package that's trying to read from the file system. That's where we'd have to throw our hands up and say, like, I'm sorry, there's no file system on the browser. We can't help you there. But assuming you're just using just vanilla JavaScript, you know, we're not going to penalize a package for shipping common JS. We can actually work with that. We'll use ESM if it's there, you know, the newer ES modules. If it's not there, we'll use what we have. We'll do our best. And we try to, like, throw warnings to make it clear, like, hey, you can't write files in a browser. This is the package that's trying to do that. But it's not a perfect story, but like it's still pretty, it's really workable. We even had some people in like simple create React app setups be able to like move to React powered Snowpack with almost no changes. And that's really cool.
Interesting. Well, that was going to be my next question was like, let's say you are a developer, just average Joe developer in today's world, and you're working on a project that's powered by Webpack. You were saying like Snowpack could kind of integrate with it. Like, what does that actually look like? And what would be the benefit today? Because if ultimately you have to go through Webpack anyways, does that mean you're still going to be kind of bottlenecked by Webpack doing all this stuff up front? I mean, I know me, I'm working on a Gatsby site right now, and it sucks. Even the cold start can be slow because it does all this stuff up front. So it's so compelling to think about not having to do all this work until I visit that page, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Your question's what is the migration story from that?
What's the migration story for someone on a Webpack project, and what are the benefits if they don't go all in on Snowpack? You know, if they still do have Webpack working. So these people that you're talking about who like integrate Snowpack with Create React app, does it just make it faster?
The no install time is a really big one. They would actually have to not eject, but basically use Snowpack in lieu of Create React app.
Gotcha.
Migration story, it isn't perfect, especially if you've gotten into like some heavy configuration there. It might not translate one-to-one. Same with Webpack though. If you're running a pretty standard, very little config, in a lot of cases, you can just delete your configuration and move to Snowpack, assuming you're using like mostly default stuff.
That's cool. Is there a guide on that? Because a lot of my Create React apps are like demos or small side projects, and I don't get anywhere near Webpack config, man. I still haven't ever configured Webpack, and I hope to keep it that way. It'd be cool to think if basically you're saying you wouldn't really have to change a lot if you had a out of the box Create React app and you wanted to go over to Snowpack.
Yeah, not a whole lot. We actually do have something called Create Snowpack app, if you've seen that.
Oh, cool.
For new projects, there's a React template. There's a React TypeScript template. There's also Vue, Svelte. There's a few different starter projects. Nice. So you can run that Create Snowpack app and it'll scaffold something. And right now the migration story is like, maybe use that, get your bare bones set up, and then just start moving your source code over.
I see. Yep. Cool. Cause basically everything in source, since you're authoring in ES modules and Snowpack's still going to take care of like bare module imports and like node resolution and all that stuff, right? And you're still going to have a package JSON. You're still going to have node modules. Is it just when you run like, how does it work again? When you run yarn install, Snowpack's going to create like a web modules folder, something like that?
Yeah, you got it.
Cool. And then during development when maybe you could actually go through it, because I have like a loose understanding of this, but I think it would be interesting to explain for a listener who doesn't know about Snowpack yet and just how it differs from like the normal workflow with a Webpack enabled app.
Yeah, sure. I'll do my best to describe it using hand motions and also for the audio listeners, just using the sound of my voice so you can imagine what's happening. So I won't be like, on line 37, remember when we said that thing? A lot of the speed comes from just having to install when you run yarn install. So you're doing the same thing with your package JSON. You know, I have a React app. It requires React, React DOM, React router, that sort of thing. When you run yarn install, you can set up a hook in the npm scripts in package.json. There's a couple of hooks that will tap into that. We like using the prepare one. So whenever you have a script called prepare in your package.json, that will just automatically run after npm install is run.
Okay.
So we set prepare in a lot of our, and we do this automatically with create Snowpack app. So you can see how it's done. Every time you install, what Snowpack will do is, it'll loop through all your dependencies. And, if you want to, you actually have it scan your source so that it only is installing the ones you're actually using.
Nice.
You know, that way you're not ending up with a lot of like, you know, maybe you installed a few too many packages or you're just playing with something. That way it won't try to go through everything. But it'll do exactly what you described. After you've run yarn install, assuming you have that script set up, it'll go through your dependencies, and then it'll create single file versions of those dependencies. And I'll get back to that in a second. And then it saves it to a web modules folder. And so when you write your code, you're still writing import React from React, the same thing you're probably used to at the top of every file. But then when that gets built out, run through Snowpack, that'll get converted into import React from, and then it's an actual URL. And you can specify your web modules. You know, it'll be like /webmodules/react.js. And so it'll print out an ESM-friendly version, or a browser-friendly ESM standard version of your script that knows exactly where to find that file. And the reason why we do one file for dependency is just network load. So that way, you know, because if you actually open up React, like React has a bunch of sub-dependencies. Like it has, you know, React is, you know, there's all these other things. And React is no strange, like React is not different than other packages. A lot of other packages do that. And so we want to flatten that because we don't want to pay the network cost of that, what we call like the cascade of, you know, you hit React imports something, got to download that, parse it, scan it. That hits something, download, parse it, you know, scan it for imports. And then the browser will do that cascade. And that is, overcoming that is one of the big barriers to going ES modules. So, there's other things that Snowpack does to alleviate that. But yeah, single file dependencies are one of them.
Interesting. Okay. And those web modules are not going to be in your repo. Like they're going to be ignored. They're just basically a build artifact.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And okay. So that makes sense. So then... So then the files that load in the browser, like you said, they use a URL for the modules that they load, and your Snowpack server is serving up those at that location, web modules or whatever. And how does it work with like deduplication and everything? Because the way NPM works is like, it was made for the server environment where it doesn't matter. There's basically no cost to like requiring another module and just having another copy or n copies of it on disk, which is why it's such a bad fit for the browser, right? I mean, that's one of the whole reasons why there are so many gains to be had from this kind of architecture. So what's the strategy there? Is there any work that goes into trying to deduplicate or flatten the dependency graph?
Yeah, we do for sure. And this is actually like duplication is one of the biggest pains of having a bundler, you know, like Webpack or Parcel or something like that. Especially when you get into code splitting and you load chunks asynchronously, there's a ton of deduplicate or there's a ton of duplicated code there. So what Snowpack does is if, you know, by default, it'll try to flatten everything to a single file if it can. But if multiple modules share some common subdependency, if you look when Snowpack runs its install inside web modules, you'll see a common folder. And so we'll also save dependencies there. So basically, like among your dependencies, nothing gets duplicated. We'll flatten as much as we can, but we also keep things true to the actual NPM dependency as much as possible, because that also provides a really good story for caching, right? And that's another downside of using a more traditional bundler like Webpack. You know, even if you have all of your NPM code in one vendor bundle, which is a good strategy, even if it's separate from your app code, as soon as you change one dependency, that whole vendor bundle has to re-download. And no matter how you code split, especially if you're dealing with like asynchronous code, you run into that problem just like at scale, just multiplied by the number of you know, chunks that you have. Right. Because Webpack doesn't know, like if you have a dependency that loads on three pages, a user might only hit one of those pages, right? So like it has to put it in all three asynchronous chunks. And then also, anytime any one of the, like, if a single character changes in any of those bundles, it's now invalidated and you have to pay the full cost again of downloading. And in an ES module world, not even Snowpack specifically, you can do this without Snowpack. This is not anything special. In ES module world, you basically expose that dependency graph to the browser. So the browser can make really intelligent decisions. It can truly only re-download what actually it's changed. And that's in my mind, like the biggest advantage of using ES module of like, it caches so well,
That's crazy. I mean, that's such a different story. I mean, honestly, like every time I go down this path, like of thinking about how all this works, it's kind of mind blowing that any of it works at all. Because if you think about just the trans, like you're talking about the sub dependencies, right? The whole graph, and you're relying on React 16.8, and you use a library that depends on 16.7. And if you ever peek inside node modules, like you might have 100 copies of React by the time you're all done with it. And it's like, how is this possibly working? So how does that actually work? Like with Snowpack, you're basically saying, let's say React is a shared dependency and it's used on page one and it's used on page two. And in a Webpack world, Webpack would just put your page one code with React, and then the other bundle for page two would include the page two code with React, because if a user only visits page two, well, they need React. If they only visit page one, they need React. But the problem is you visit page one, you download React and page one code, then you go to page two, and now you re-download React and the page two code, right? That's kind of like the problem.
Right.
So what is it like with Snowpack? Are you just making two different requests, and the request for React is like keyed by that URL? And so when you go from page one to page two, if page two also relies on the same exact version that is keyed by the same URL, then the browser can just say, I already got it.
Yeah. Yeah, you got it.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And so Snowpack is just doing that for you automatically, basically.
Right. Yeah. And again, this is just ES module. This is just how ES modules were designed to work, not even Snowpack. Like Snowpack is just a tool to help you use ES module. You can do all this on your own. Again, you just have to find a way to like compile React, and just like the little, you know, annoyances that make it worth it have to have some tooling. But like, let's assume that you wrote all your dependencies by hand and you wanted to use ES module. Yeah, you could even work on across like multiple subdomains, you know, like you can load something just from one place. If that's the same dependency, and if you're saying this is the same dependency, that one URL will work no matter how you load that. And the browser does a really good job, because like what you described there with React being duplicated across bundles, like that's not a flaw of Webpack or anything. It's just the strategy of bundling is putting it all in one file. So like, and it, we had to in a world before browsers understood what import even was. And so there was only one way to do it back then. And it's great. But the whole module system is simulated, and that's just the cost you pay for it, is you pay for that duplication when you code split. You pay for that caching, because again, it's only one request. And so it's just that double-edged sword of, you get the advantage of one network request, but there's downsides to that. And likewise, ES module, like you get perfect caching. Users never download the same code again. But what you have to do is you have to solve other problems that are introduced by that, like the cascade, If this was truly exposed, if you truly just, that's why Snowpack does a little bit of work.
Right.
To flatten the dependency as much as possible, because if you truly had something that was just like NPM, if mm-hmm. you really just threw all of NPM online, just theoretically, you know, like everything would slow down a lot,
right.
just trying to dig through all these files, you know, because a browser doesn't know what a JavaScript file is imported until it's actually like downloaded it and basically like analyzed it.
Right. Right. So yeah, basically because the network is slower than reading from disk, that becomes like a fundamental limiting operation. And so it makes sense to do some work up front where we know, all right, whenever you use React, you're going to need these 100 modules that are really what constitute React. Let's throw them together in one file and just save you some work. Basically, that's the idea, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And especially, and we have a way of scanning. Is there anything else that's using this? Like, is there any other thing that needs access to this? No, this is all just internal within React. Okay. React, you are one file because we realistically don't need to just load part of this.
I see. But if React used Lodash, a module from Lodash, but then also another one of my top level dependencies used Lodash or a module from Lodash, I would want ideally that to be shared and ideally the browser to hit an import statement that had the same URL for both of those files.
Yes.
So that way it could cache it and that way it wouldn't have to. Yeah. It just solves all the problems that we just talked about. Interesting. So do you see, like, if you look at the real world output of one of these apps, do you end up seeing like different versions of transitive dependencies a lot of the times where you'll have multiple versions of React? And if so, like what even happens when your program, you click page two and someone's using, you know, my Google Calendar widget and it like tries to load another version of React?
Yeah. I think the quick answer to that is we haven't seen that problem yet.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is something that we're thinking about. That's something that we actually handle with the Pika CDN. There's a little bit of magic there because we do have this concept of like there is technically a different version of React there if you built it and then a sub-dependency has changed, even if the React version hasn't changed, you know, because mm-hmm. like that's a whole other like rabbit hole that I am not right. qualified to speak on. You know, like Isaac of NPM wrote this blog post series on Arborist, like their dependency management system, on the NPM blog.
I'm not familiar with that.
That's really fascinating. Like the whole like package resolution thing work that the NPM team has put in, that the Yarn team has done as uh-huh. well. That is fascinating and way beyond my comprehension, but like it kind of hits at that problem, right? Of like all these different versions don't always cleanly map to one another. Like sometimes, yeah. versions of a package, especially if you have it, if you don't have it locked to a specific patch version, which few libraries do.
Right.
Yeah, that actually affects the final code of being a transitive right. dependency.
Right. What was the name of that from Isaac's post?
It was, if you go to the NPM blog, I think it's the most recent one. It's called okay. Arborist. It is the engine that powers module resolution in NPM. Like when you hit NPM install, you know, package A requires package C, package B requires package C. They both requested different versions.
Right.
But they both need package C. What do you do?
Right.
You can't just, you know, that way, if you gave every package the specific version it requested, that would explode out into a real big mess.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that how, I thought that's how Node works and NPM install works on the server by default. Like, I thought that was one of the whole architectural decisions behind NPM, at least back in the day, which was like, instead of making you deal with dependency hell, we're just going to give each module its own version, and that way you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, that was the original design. But if I remember correctly, like the package lock concept didn't exist for a while.
Gotcha.
I might be getting this wrong. I think until Yarn, I think Yarn introduced the package lock and then NPM followed suit.
Yes.
Double check me on that.
Yep. No, I think that's right. And back in some of my Ember work and with the folks who do the build tooling work there, we were running into this for the same reason, because you'd end up with like multiple versions of client side packages running in the browser, which doesn't work the way it's not a good solution, because there's one environment and you can't have a little sandbox the way you can in Node, right? And so I think Yarn and now npm install does their best to flatten the dependency graph. So if it can find a single version of a dependency that overlaps with both A and B's needs, then it will say, all right, we found this version. It works for both. Let's just give it the one. And that's why, like, starting, I don't know, a year or two ago, if you look in Node modules, like, you see a lot of packages that are not your top level package JSON. Whereas before, it would literally just be a tree and it would be like your top levels and then it would go in. And so you could imagine like different versions of transitive dependencies living farther down the tree. Whereas now it does, I think Yarn install, npm install, it does their best to flatten and hoist up the dependency and give you a single version. But I don't think it's perfect. I think that mm-hmm. you would err on the side of correctness and giving something the version that it actually requests, as opposed to saying, oh, this one requested version 2, this one requested version 3. Let's just give them version 3 and hope everything works.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if you're not dealing with, it's really, really weird combinations these days that you start to see this with. For the most part, this is great because users don't have to deal with this. Developers mm-hmm. Don't have to know how any of this works. It just, mm-hmm. it just does. And that's wonderful. That's the story that I want to, you know, keep contributing to. For like an ES module world, you know, that story does apply, right? Where it's like, you have this React 16 dot whatever, but it's kind of a little bit of a lie because mm-hmm. like you said, those sub dependencies, which could change without a new version release based on when you built that package, it's almost like there's hidden subversions even mm-hmm. within like a patch version.
Absolutely.
So when you're dealing with it with Snowpack by default, you know, we build everything and then you're actually uploading the files yourself. So again, it's that stepping stone where like you're not using this like global CDN, right? You're still hosting the JavaScript, but you're making it more transparent to the browser. But, you know, whatever the version of React is, no matter how many different ways you loaded it, like that's your version of React locked to the transitive dependencies. And we flattened all that for you. So that's going to work for you. But what you just raised of like, how does that work at scale for multiple right. people? And that's right. a problem that we actually do have to solve on the Pika CDN. And,
yeah.
And we do our best to do that of like, basically just preferring like the most recent build.
Yeah.
You know, and we just, we haven't run into any problems with that, but yeah, when transit dependencies change, we do have to rebuild stuff, keep the most recent version, even if the top level package version hasn't changed. But again, yeah. the dream is we just handle all of that and most people don't ever have to think about it.
Yeah, yeah. I think the few times we would run into these issues and then you start taking a peek under the hood of what's actually happening, you're like, oh, wow, there are multiple versions of this library running and I didn't happen to run into a bug yet, but that's not right. I think with like Yarn resolutions, you can basically give the developer the choice to say like, all right, whatever, I don't care what versions that they say, give them 16.8. And even if they say we only work with 16.7 down, we're just going to say, I verify that it works for my use case with 16.8. And so I'm just going to have one version of it. But it sounds like really the ultimate solution here is for library authors to be more liberal with their version constraints. So if you're making a calendar widget and right now, if you just create, like there's this tool called TSDX, I think, which is like a way to bootstrap a new TypeScript library and it sets up like roll up and everything for you. I think a lot of these tools are just by default going to, for library authors, going to give you a package JSON with specific versions, right? It'll be like, this work was with React 16.8.2 with a caret. And so now we're going to say 16.8 and up with patch releases, whatever. But really what you want is to be as wide range as possible, right? And say, I work with 16, I work with 15, you know, or I work with Lodash version 1 or 2. Because if every dependency was as wide range as possible, when it comes time to actually Yarn install and Yarn does its thing or NPM does its thing or even Pika package or Snowpack does its thing, it can say, all right, now we can boil this down and have the fewest number of duplicate dependencies as possible, right?
I think I followed that.
It's just basically like if I say I need Lodash, if I say my thing works with Lodash dot map version 1.1 and your thing says it needs 1.2, but really they both work together, like it feels like we almost need a cultural change from the perspective of the library authors to say, and to test their code to say, I work with any version Lodash 1. And then when 2 comes out, instead of bumping it to 2, you just test against 1 and 2 and you say, my thing works with 1 and 2, right? And if every library did that, then these tools would be a lot more powerful and we avoid a lot of the clashing dependencies and the duplicate dependencies that can cause problems sometimes. I guess the question is how big of a problem that is, but it seems like that would be ideal, you know?
Right, yeah. Like what you raised, I don't know of a solution to it. There isn't really a solution, right? Because it is complex. It is kind of related to a whole suite of problems of just a really diverse ecosystem of there's, you know, JavaScript to its benefit and detriment is a very flexible language. There are all different ways to write JavaScript. And it's helpful now that we're moving into a world where there is actually a module system in JavaScript. Yeah. And so we're no longer in the different module wars of all these different competing standards. So it makes it a little easier. We're still dealing with that of like a version still controlled by the package author. There's nothing we can really do at scale to enforce that. Yes, every patch, you know, like that's the goal of SimVersion, right? Is minor and patch versions work perfectly, you know? So theoretically you should, you know, any major version should work theoretically, but like there's really no way to ensure that every package doesn't. I would say practically it's not a problem that I've run into a lot, but there isn't a solution, so we're still just kind of at least at Pika and even just outside, even the projects I worked on, I've just have been just reliant on package authors to do the right thing, and for the most part, in large part, they do. And it just works.
Incredible. I don't either. But it is kind of incredible. When you take a peek under the hood, there's a lot going on there. Cool. So Snowpack is focused on speeding this stuff up. It works today. I do remember using Create Snowpack app. Once you mentioned that, it rung a bell because I think Rich Harris was tweeting about it. He made some kind of snarky British comment about, even though I'm an author of a bundler, these guys make me want to use an unbundler for my dev. And so I was like, I got to try this. So I ran Create Snowpack app with the Svelte template. And my almost broke my neck because it was so fast. It was crazy. I didn't even realize I had hit enter and it had already built. So it's cool. I'll have to do that next time I make a little demo project in React. Basically, there's nothing I'm going to... I mean, I'm sure there's some stuff in Create React app. Like, what's the testing story like? Is there, if I do a Create Snowpack app with the React template, is there a way to add tests to that?
In React app, there actually is a test setup with Jest and Kent C. Dodd's amazing React testing library. So we have that all ready to go, all set up for you. Check on the other templates. I don't think that we have testing in every different language template that we have. But pull requests are always welcome. It's open source.
And that's cool. And those templates are those are under the official Pika organization and everything?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we've seen a lot of good community support of people improving them and giving us feedback on how this works or doesn't work for them. And so we've spent a lot of time in the past couple of weeks responding to that. But we've seen good response from it, and we do commit to maintain that all the templates are working.
Nice.
And are just a reasonable good foundation for getting started. I've built some side projects myself, and they're pretty easy to use if I do say so myself.
Nice.
And fast, like you mentioned. Like Fred and I were kind of joking this week because I submitted a pull request to improve the error logging during startup time, and I actually added a little status message in the terminal dashboard that says installing your dependencies. But most of the time that flashes for just like a couple milliseconds. It was the joke of like, why are we even doing this? Of like, why are we even showing status when it only lasts for a couple of milliseconds? But we are.
Man, if that does not get you excited to try this thing out, I don't know what does, because that is really, really awesome. What would the story be like? Maybe something that would help someone want to try it out is if I started with this and then I'm like, all right, I need this extra thing, or like I'm already comfortable with Webpack and I need more power. And like, would the migration path from Snowpack to like a more mature setup look kind of the same as what you talked to me at the beginning of the show, which is like, you can just set up the new thing however you want and just kind of copy over your source, since you're still authoring all of your app source in the same way that you would in a Webpack world.
Yeah, yeah. And the goal is for your source to be the same way you're used to writing it. And so we really wanted to buy into that. Like, you shouldn't have to change your app code just to get all these cool features.
Right.
There are some things, though, that you do miss out on from migrating away from Snowpack, such as remote module loading. You know, if you are using a CDN to serve your stuff, which is pretty cool, other build tools don't support that right now. Even though Webpack is, they are adding remote modules soon, I believe. But I might be mistaken. I don't believe it exists yet. Some older build systems don't support loading React from my React CDN that others can benefit from, a remote URL. But you can do that in Snowpack.
That's cool. Now, when you do that in Snowpack, where do you set that up? Is there a module map config somewhere, or do you actually put that in your application code?
I believe right now we require you to write that in your app code.
Got you. So you could just put it right there, import React from, and then put a whole URL. And it basically, Snowpack will just, anything that's a URL, I'm guessing Snowpack just ignores, because it's already ready for the browser to do what it's going to do with. And then it turns the bare word into the actual imports.
Yeah, exactly. We have ways to scan your source directory, and so it can just automatically pull out imports you're using. And as soon as you stop using an import, it'll just stop installing it.
Gotcha.
And so we actually do sniff out. If it's a URL, we just ignore it. We just say, you're good. Like, you're in control. You're already using ESM. What are we going to do for you?
That's so cool. It's really cool.
I think we have messed around. We've done some more experimental stuff where we've there's like a flag. You can like opt into the Pika CDN. It's undocumented now because that might change. So we're going to do a little more testing, but look forward to more cool stuff like that. Like just being able to pass a config and then swap some stuff with a Pika CDN, or maybe even your CDN of choice at build time.
That makes sense.
So look out for that, maybe.
Doesn't Dino do something like that where because all imports are URLs, but the same thing came up? I think I came across this when I was doing some reading on it. They have basically a header file that's like a mapping. Or an index file of some kind.
I think so.
Yeah. Where you can specify the versions of things. Dino is interesting because it seems like they are doing multiple things. One is this, similar to this idea, which is like, we don't need to bundle for a variety of these reasons, and we get all these benefits, which is good. But then they also seem like they're doing like, we don't need package management, which is like a separate thing. And that's not what Pika or Snowpack is like. It's a separate problem.
Yeah, kind of. It does get an interesting question that Fred and I have talked about. I don't have an answer to, which is, in this ES module world, what is a package? Because package JSON goes away, you know? Like, what is metadata for a package? At the end of the day, these are all just JavaScript files. It is an interesting question of like, is there information now? Like, are there different versions of this? Because you know, all that exists in ES modules is just this idea of JavaScript. So package JSON is just kind of this like proprietary meta level that we're still using. We're still in that world where we're using package JSON. But the question of like, what does that look like in the future? You know, like what constitutes a module? What constitutes a package? I think is a question that I think it'll be really cool just to see as a community, like what the JavaScript community comes together with. Does that make sense?
It does. It's just, again, this is kind of where I start to get confused because the stuff is so complex. But yeah. I was talking to my buddy who does a lot of work on build tooling in Ember, he was basically saying, like, it's cool. Every module is a file that the browser requests. But if you don't live in a world like what you were talking about, where like literally every module import is just requesting the entire graph, and like instead we want to flatten things out for practical reasons, then you still need a notion of dependency resolution. Because if you don't, then yeah, it's like not pragmatic. Like, what does it mean to depend on React? There is no notion of that in Dino, I think. Basically, like, you can't say I depend on React. But like, that's actually turns out to be a useful thing for the sake of like, deduplicating things, reproducible builds, like making sure, the thing is reproducible. And so if you're not going to put fully qualified URLs with versions for every single import in the entire graph of your app, then like dependency resolution is still an important thing to have, basically. That's kind of his argument. And so he was saying, it's fine that they use the imports. That's cool, but they still need a dependency resolution strategy. And on the Deno website, you see them say, oh, there's a convention here. Like, you can make a header file, like an index header file, and specify what versions of things you mean. So you have like this light layer of abstraction. It's like you're basically reinventing package lock at that point. So that, I think that was his perspective. So that's kind of, I don't know, that's interesting. It does get confusing because they kind of overlap a little bit, the two ideas.
Right. Yeah. And I think like to simplify it, hopefully, the world we're living in now is kind of like a two-pronged approach, where the problem you describe is if you're loading from a CDN, right, you do have to have like some kind of concept of version, the URL. Mm-hmm. The other approach is if you're hosting all these files yourself, built by Snowpack or some other ESM tool, like, The version lock is like, it's what you need because it's built like, it was built with that kind of like implicit understanding of your application used this, you tested this, you know this works, this is like your, this is your version that you need, maybe not someone else needs. It works as long as you have, and that's what Snowpack does by default, you know, you own the version of React that you need. Yeah, but like for the Pika CDN, we do have to have versions in the URL for that specific reason.
Exactly. And for really, it's like you really don't need it for apps as much as you do for libraries, right? Because libraries have this notion and like you want to share it. So like if I want to share my library with you, that's where like dependency resolution comes in. That's where Semver matters, right? Like Semver, like for all of its faults, Semver and the node module resolution algorithm make it easy to share code. And so if you take all that stuff away, it becomes hard. We go back to like where we were 15 years ago, and like you can copy code from my website, but like, does it work with this other code? Does it, am I safe to upgrade a version when it comes out? I feel like that's where the Deno ecosystem would need a new strategy to make it easier to share code. And we're also like, these new tools are going to still have to, again, meeting developers where they're at, ensure like it's easy for me to just install a package that depends on React. Oh, my app depends on React too. Okay, we can consolidate those two things because they both speak the same language. They both have Semver or whatever it is, right?
This is an interesting problem because it's one that we really haven't seen before. With JavaScript being a script language, you know, that executes in runtime. Yeah, like you raise a really good point. Like, what does that mean when you're loading from this URL and there's not a version in there? You know, when you're loading from Deno, what does that mean? Because these are being resolved basically on the fly, compared to, say, like Go, a compiled language, and Go, you know, Go modules operate off of like usually GitHub URLs or whatever. But like, you know, there is this concept, like Go is not evaluated on the fly, right? It's like they have some version of like a lock file or like an equivalent of it. I'm not a gopher. I'm probably using the wrong term, but like, if you build it, you build Go, you deploy it, and like, there is no resolution that happens. Like, even if like that code, all those dependencies are changing in real time, but like, what you're actually seeing in that Go application is that compiled version that is static.
It's frozen. Yeah. Yeah. It's like frozen version of it. But didn't they start out with no sort of lock file, but then basically added it back in?
Go modules itself didn't really exist, or it went through a lot of revisions. I'm not the best person to speak on it, but I'm a I'm a baby gopher.
You like it?
Yeah, I like it. It's fun. I haven't done a little bit. I haven't done Go recently.
What were
I do
you
appreciate
using it for?
A lot of the. My last company, Manifold, was they were very Go. Go was all the backend services and stuff.
Cool.
So did a little bit, like, very into microservices. Very good for that. It is really cool. I'm also a big fan of Rust too, but it was like a light bulb went off, a little bit of a side tangent when I was using Go as a primarily JavaScript engineer, was not being able to use these really cool functional style stuff, you know. I had a joke between me and my coworkers where I would ask how to do something in Go, and they'd be like, a for loop. I'd be like, a for loop? That's so, like, what year is it? Like, 1998? I had to write a for loop for everything. And I was like, why can't I just, like, do these cool map and reduce and stuff that I'm used to in JavaScript? But then when I saw the design constraint of Go is, like, a linear runtime, I'm like, okay, I can get behind that. So, like, Go will not let you write inefficient code, and that's really cool.
What does that mean? I know we can't start a whole new podcast episode here, but what does that mean? Linear runtime, like, from a perspective of, like, stacks or something like that? Like,
I mean, just, this is where I'm going to talk about Big O notation in a really dumb way, but, my understanding of it is, like, you know, in JavaScript, you can write inefficient code when you're doing multiple, you know, like if you have like a filter that's chained with a map that's chained with a reduce, you know, you're like taking this array and you're that's not linear runtime. For every item in the array, you're multiplying the work by a factor of three.
I see. Interesting.
And so Go, you know, it's, you can do the same operations in Go, but like there's not, you can't call like a single function in Go that will let you like, exponentially increase the execution of that program, basically.
I see. Oh, cool. And that's like at the language design level.
Yeah. So that was a tenet that they had. And so like they try to give you the best developer experience possible, and Go is a really concise, easy to read, easy to write language, you know, for its power. And it saves you from having to do things like garbage collecting, which is nice, you know, which is also be familiar to JavaScript devs. So
right.
Go, you know, Go is compiled and it's a different beast than JavaScript. Right. But it's, you know, there's a lot of documentation, there's a lot of community support, it's a mature language. It has, you know, a lot of the module system is really well designed. So it's, I would recommend giving it a try.
Interesting.
Again, I'm also a fan of Rust too. I've been more interested in Rust lately, but I really do appreciate Go's design.
and the fact that it's compiled gives it a portability that makes it well suited for microservices, right? Is that why a lot of teams use it? That's like one thing I heard about it.
It's that, and also the HTTP, the network functions like built into Go, the library itself, are phenomenal.
Cool.
You know, like something like, I actually haven't done any Python development, but like my knowledge, like Python or like other languages, or it's just like, you do have to do a lot of like importing, and like sometimes the experience is not great just dealing with just raw network stuff. But Go was designed to operate on a network. And so cool. Just like the, you know, vanilla Go, if you want to call it that, the stuff built into Go is really efficient. And a lot of people, I would say most Go developers, to my understanding, don't even really use like a server framework with Go
at all.
Just the core language is that good, you know?
Interesting.
Like there is no express for Go. You just write Go because that's just a part of the language.
Interesting. So the standard library has basically all the primitives you'd need to build a basic server.
Yeah. And you, there definitely are frameworks for more advanced things like GraphQL, or like definitely there's obviously specialized tools that exist.
Sure.
But if you're writing these like, you know, like Lambda function style things, if you're writing these functions like raw or just writing like a really simple server, just you don't need anything other than Go.
It's pretty cool. Okay, so anyways, to pop back a few layers off the stack here, their module system, it did start, I do think it started out, and then they basically ended up adding back in a lock file or some notion of dependency resolution. I expect the same thing will happen to Dino, or that's the conventions around what they're recommending now will just become more and more ingrained until you effectively have something like a package lock, right? I mean, it seems like that is a possibility.
Right, yeah. It's something that we as a entire JavaScript community have to figure out together. And I say it's a new problem because, I mean, there's so many things that exist in computer science that have been around for decades that get revived. You know, like I think of like XState is a good example of that. Yes. And, you know, David K. Piano is the first to say, like, I'm just stealing from all these classical, you know, mathematics papers. Like, this is not my idea. But like this idea of like module resolution with a, you know, with a script that's evaluated at runtime, that's resolving modules over the internet, you know, the super large scale network. Like, I'm not saying that something like it hasn't existed, but this is a new problem, like dealing it's at the scale unique. That we're dealing with, mm-hmm. with the current, you know, just the current, like the greater ecosystem of like programming of, you know, where we even load code on GitHub, you know, like this is a new problem that we haven't seen before, especially at this scale of like,
right.
you know, so it'll take a lot of noodling to work out a solution here.
It's an interesting problem for sure. Well, I think that's probably a good spot to about start wrapping it up. Is there anything else you're working on or kind of coming down the pike for Pika you and Fred are doing that you're really excited about? Or is y'all's focus just to kind of iron out Snowpack now that V2 is shipped? What's kind of in your near-term roadmap?
Something that would be good to plug is ES Next Conf, which if you go to esnextconf.com, it is a conference that we're putting on in July, and it is a remote conference just talking about the future of JavaScript.
Nice. Fully remote conference. All right. Very cool.
So,
and it's all about
check that out.
What's next for JavaScript? Looks great. I'm going to definitely add this to the show notes for sure. What do you think JavaScript will look like in 5 years? Nice.
Yeah, we're reviewing the talks. Like we hope to put out a speaker list next week, hopefully, as of the recording of this at least. So be on the lookout for speakers. Just looking through the talks and the people that submitted and the engineers that submitted, I'm super excited for it. There are some great topics.
That's awesome. I mean, I think it's a pretty exciting space right now. Obviously, a lot of bright people are working on things like Snowpack, things related to ES modules. So, super interesting stuff. Very cool, man. Very cool. Awesome. Drew, well, thank you so much for joining. And I'm sure everyone learned a thing or two. And I know I want to try out. I mean, trying out Snowpack is as easy as it is to try out Create React app the next time I need a React app, right? So I know I'm going to be doing that. Hope y'all have enjoyed this conversation and give it a shot as well. If folks want to kind of keep up with you, where should they go? Are you on Twitter? Are you somewhere else?
You can look me up on Twitter. My handle is DRWPOW, short for Drew Powell.
Nice.
That's it. Just catch me on Twitter.
Awesome. And then kind of keeping up with Pika, I guess that you said most of the repos are open source right on GitHub.
Yeah. Yeah. Snowpack.dev is the main site. Those have the docs for Snowpack. If you click into the GitHub link, then you'll see all the related repos. There's even some repos that in the greater Pika ecosystem that I'm a big fan of that don't get as much coverage, such as Pika Pack, which if you're a maintainer of any kind of package on NPM, I found Pika Pack to be invaluable in building and packaging and doing all the right things to get my NPM package ready for, you know, this world of ES modules.
Oh, cool.
There's a lot more tools than just Snowpack in the Pika ecosystem that are worth checking out for sure. Awesome. And you can find all that from snowpack.dev if you start digging into the GitHub links from there.
Awesome. I'm going to check that out for sure as someone who has spent way more time than I ever imagined getting Rollup and Babel and Jest and all of these things working together for some of my open source projects. So I'm going to be giving that one a look real soon.
Yeah, I had just as a side project, this was a year ago, I had a just a custom thing that I was building with my own rollup configuration that I had my own test. I had, and I replaced it with Pika Pack, basically in 15 minutes. And now it manages that and it does a better job than I did. So,
wow, that's awesome. Sounds like you guys are solving some real, real cool problems, real important problems. Again, man, thank you so much for coming on. That was a really cool conversation. Wish you and Fred the best, and I will keep keeping an eye on all the work y'all are doing. So thanks again, Drew, for joining us, and thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Take care.
Bye-bye.